From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
I have to remember.
So there's only one Marina Hampton, that's you. So what happens to the next Marina Hampton?
Oh, she'll have to pick something else.
She'll just go for something else. Okay, very good.
And as soon as they wake up in the morning, 74% of people reach for the smartphone. That's pretty depressing, isn't it?
Kardashians meets the Real Housewives with a Carrie twist.
With a Carrie
twist.
That's
how I pitched it. That was my elevated pitch.
There you go, so
coming up on this sunny Thursday edition of Playback Daily, the work benefits of union membership, the mental health benefits of ditching your smartphone, and the career benefits of publishing your first novel. That's all on the way over the next hour of the Radio Catch-Up Show. It's like Drake meets Kendrick at a cold Sunday morning GAA minor match. Let's begin the show today with Oliver Callan musing on the arrival of one Bruce Springsteen to our shores for his shows around the country starting tonight in Belfast.
Some good news for music fans. Bruce Springsteen is among us. He is in Ireland today. He's landed here. He's here for the start of what will be a 10-day visit for four shows with his E Street Band. So he's in Belfast tonight. Enjoy that. He's in Kilkenny on Sunday, next Thursday, this day week, in Cork, and then Croke Park, Dublin, on Sunday, the 19th of May. So he's here for a long old trip. I wonder what he'll be doing around Ireland. Will he be spotted? And the only sign that he is, in fact, a 74-year-old man, which is easy to forget when he plays his 3 hours of stomping hits, the only sign is that he's left some gaps between the three shows. So by the time he heads off to the Labba after that Croke Park show, he'll have played to 1 million people in Ireland in total in his career ever since his very first concert here nearly 40 years ago now, Slane Castle, 1985. So the boss is among us. Enjoy, have fun, all that crack.
He is among us. What a time to be alive. Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band live. There is very little like it in this world. But enough boss eulogising. What about the fast approaching Summer Olympics?
Paris Olympian Eve McMahon. She is a native of Sutton in Dublin, North Dublin there. She's going to compete for Ireland in the Olympic Sailing Regatta. Why is she in the news today? Eve McMahon is going to participate in the Olympic Torch Relay because the flame begins its journey today on French soil from Marseille to Paris. It's a lovely thing, the Olympic flame, that iconic kind of rally that they hold. It's a recognisable tradition of the Olympic Games, and it's the link between the modern and the ancient Olympics when they started out in the 19th century, restarted the Olympics in the 19th century. That's the modern Olympics. So it was lit in Olympia in Greece, as it always is, this time on the 16th of April, because its journey is a little bit shorter. It's obviously only going to Paris this time, so it's travelling around the place. And Eve McMahon will participate in that for Ireland. She'll be one of the youngest members of the Irish Olympic team this summer, and she's on her first Olympic Games. McMahon was selected by the French Embassy in Ireland as our representative to participate in the torch relay. So enjoy that. There's huge security for the relay. It's in Marseille, and it's like that lovely, beautiful tradition. But loads of security in France. There are always tensions in France, aren't there? Tensions in France, particularly now. They're always rowing with somebody over there.
Does RTE condone the use of national stereotypes on the airwaves?
Certainement pas.
But what is there for people who, you know, don't really care for sport? Why, there's Eurovision, of course.
Eurovision semi-final 2. It is happening tonight. It'll be at 8 o'clock on RTÉ2 televisions. On RTÉ2 television tonight. This is the one that features Israel, controversially, given the horrendous war on Gaza. And we hear in the news, of course, that many people in Ireland are refusing to watch any of Eurovision in protest at the European Broadcasting Union's decision to admit Israel as an entry. But there is little evidence of the boycott, I could tell you, having any effect here anyway, because the audience that tuned in to watch Bambi Thug qualify for the final in Tuesday's semi was absolutely enormous. 360,000 people here watched it on RTE1. That doesn't include the people who were watching on BBC1. That's an average of 35.4% of the available audience. And it was up against a big Champions League match. So that was a huge no sign of people turning off Eurovision in this country anyway. 55% of televiewers tuned in to watch the results when it came through. And Bambi Thug, they got through to the final. So a similar bumper television audience, we'll be expecting them to tune in on Saturday because the hype around Bambi, it is growing by the hour. I can tell you their live performance, it was uploaded to YouTube after Tuesday night. It was viewed nearly 3 million times in 24 hours on YouTube, which is way, way ahead of everybody else in that semi-final, including the hot favourites, Croatia. And as a result, Ireland has now moved up to effectively joint third favourites to win Eurovision 2024 outright. So we're alongside Ukraine. Ukraine just slightly ahead of us, but more or less third favourites. Croatia on top, then Switzerland, then ourselves and Ukraine. It's kind of hard to believe, isn't it, given the poor performances we've had in recent years. So semi-final two is tonight. The one to watch tonight is Switzerland, of course. They are the second favourites after all. You're going to see them for the first time. Here's a sample of Nemo, and their song is called Code, The Code. There's the song title. Yes, a lot of time. Get to the point. Oh, there it is again. And Nemo goes into a rap. It's kind of a high octane song. We played it here in full a couple of weeks ago when it hit the top favourites, but Croatia's pipped it at the minute. So that's Switzerland tonight. The Eurotrash will be provided by another favourite. That's going to be the Netherlands, with a tune that shows Eurovision's not always a music competition, but also a fun competition. Oh God. Oh, no, no, you're not banging in this door. Thank you very much. That's Europapa, of course. That is the pure trash they're going to have tonight for the Netherlands. Guaranteed to get through, by the way. And Greece is inexplicably expected to rank very strongly in tonight's semi-final. They've got a Bollywood-style thingamajiggy. Thank you, Greece. That'll do us between tonight. And I'm afraid they've got a lot of dud songs tonight. You'll be skipping around the television, but sure, like you can chat through it. It's not what the Eurovision's all about. But all Israel's, unfortunately, will be on Israel, and the booing will be expected, but Israel expected to qualify for the final with votes from countries on the continent far more sympathetic to Israel than Ireland perhaps would understand. Isn't that extraordinary news? Ireland, Spain and a couple of other EU member states are going to formally recognise the state of Palestine on the 21st of May. Talking about it for decades, but it's going to happen on there because of what's the dreadful things happening over there. That's going to be a remarkable moment. But for some, I suppose, Eurovision is the escape. For others, it's an affront. It is happening regardless of how you feel tonight.
From low culture and politics to high culture and our very own
Claire Keegan, congratulations, a friend of the show. Claire Keegan, the great Claire, has won a prestigious German award. What has she won? Well, she's been named the recipient of the Siegfried Lenz Prize for 2024. This is awarded to international writers whose creative work is deemed close to the spirit of Siegfried Lenz, who's an award-winning German writer. And he set up the prize himself, actually, just before he died. But they only give it out every 2 years. That's what makes it extra rare. Julian Barnes has won it previously. Richard Ford, Elizabeth Strout, and now Claire Keegan. And she'll get that in Hamburg in October, along with €50,000. That's a lot of money in the publishing world, I can tell you. I can tell you there for sure. Oh, yes. Are you in a book club, by the way? There are toxic book clubs, apparently, usually collapse because of WhatsApp groups around the book club. Somebody's reading one of the English papers today about being thrown out of the Jilly Cooper book club, which started with a splinter WhatsApp group and increasingly uncomfortable discussions, then blew up with an argument about the menopause. I'm guessing this is mostly women in this particular book club. And so what goes on in book club? There are thousands of book clubs up and down the land in Britain and across Ireland, and they proliferated online because of the lockdowns and all that crack, and because of Book Talk Corner on TikTok. And then loads of celebrities set up book clubs online. Dakota Johnson, Oprah already had one, Reese Witherspoon is there, Dua Lipa now has one, even Britain's Queen Camilla has her own reading room on Instagram book club thing. Book clubs are largely run by women for women, but far from being safe, sisterly spaces. Go online and you'll find hundreds of threads about the toxicity of the female book group. The false sense of belonging. The bashing of anyone who doesn't share the same opinions as you. We have a problem in our book club, reads many of the Mum's Net posts. Oh, that's the dreaded place of mammy fascism. One of our members is not as literary as us, is another comment. Even the Gen Zers are tearing themselves apart at book talk clubs. Some worry the clubs are more concerned with lifestyle aesthetic than providing a space to focus on the actual reading. A constant thing you might hear is book clubs are basically mean girls for middle class women. These are kind of tiny problems, but all the same. Every book club has its Ayatollah, usually the founder. The role brings out despotic tendencies. Stories flood in from friends about their own cancellations. One club founder would complain if others hadn't finished the book. Never mind that she didn't have a job, and that most of the members did. How hard can it be to just sit down for an afternoon and finish the book? She asked when the group met. Wow. It's vicious, vicious stuff in book clubs up and down the land. Good heavens. Is everybody okay?
A few scratches, but I'll survive. No more clubbing for me, though. Let's pull the curtain down right there on the Oliver Callan Morning Musings for today and maybe consider solo book reading as a pastime. Hay fever season seems to arrive earlier and earlier every year. But why is that? Colm O'Mungon, sitting in for Claire Byrne, spoke this morning to Monaghan GP Dr. Ilona Duffy, and that was the first question he asked her.
Well, there are a couple of theories on this. Number one, I think one fairly obvious one is that our winter is definitely warmer and shorter. And I think anybody who still cuts grass notices that they're cutting it earlier. They're seeing that grass rising. And we're also seeing flowers blossom earlier. So definitely spring is coming that bit earlier with regards to natural growth. But also we know that there is some evidence that is supporting the fact that air pollution in general can exacerbate hay fever symptoms. So it seems to be that the contaminants in the air along with the pollen seem to give a kind of more aggressive response, and therefore the hay fever symptoms become more obvious that bit earlier.
Right. So is it just streaming eyes, runny nose, sneezing and the like, or can there be other accompanying symptoms, maybe a cough or the like as well?
Well, I think hay fever often is thought of as just being a bit of the snuffles and sure you've just got a bit of hay fever. But for many people, it's much more disabling than that and really impacts on everything on their daily living when they're in the peak of it. So as you said, you can have the running eyes and the snuffles, you can have the cough, but also that can lead to hoarseness. It can lead to snoring at night. It can lead to poor sleep, both for you and anybody who's with you at night, and fatigue. And we know that there are studies that have looked at students who have hay fever during exams and that they perform less well than their counterparts who don't have hay fever. So it definitely impacts on day-to-day functioning and day-to-day living. And for those who get really severe symptoms, it can affect their breathing. So for anyone who has asthma, it can often exacerbate their asthma, meaning they're more likely to be short of breath or more likely to need their reliever inhaler and potentially be at risk of a severe asthmatic attack. So it's often for many people very disabling during their day and really they suffer a lot.
All right. And for people who are really made miserable by it and who haven't been to the doctor with it, what would you recommend across the counter for people to get immediate relief from their symptoms?
Well, many people, before they come to us, the GP, will have already tried antihistamines, and they're available over the counter. But I think it's important to go with the newer antihistamines. We know that they'll tend to last longer in your system and be less sedating. So older antihistamines, such as Paracetamol, can be very sedating. Also, don't last as long, so wear off that bit quicker. Talk to your pharmacist and try that. And they're good for people with mild intermittent symptoms. So we know today, here in Monaghan, the sun is shining. It's warm already. We know that pollen count will start to rise. And the pollen count, as the pollen is released from the kind of the blossoms or from the trees or the grasses, what happens is it tends to rise in the air and will stay in our air and therefore circulating and exposing people to it until later in the evening. So on a day like today, people may start noticing later on in the day, as they're exposed to the pollen, the snuffles. Take the antihistamines on those days. The next step, though, for those who are having persistent symptoms or really are being impacted on a day-to-day basis with it, we talk about nasal sprays. And these, in general, are steroid nasal sprays. And how they work is that they reduce inflammation and irritability in the airway, so they reduce the blockage of the nose, they reduce some of the eye symptoms, that itchy, burning eyes, and also they'll stop the streaming nose and therefore the cough.
Are they a prescription medication?
Well, there are some of the steroid sprays are available over the counter, and it's worth trying them. There probably are better ones with kind of better what we call bioavailability that are available on prescription, but even you could talk to your pharmacist, and there are some of the steroid sprays available. Unfortunately, they tend to be twice a day. There are better ones that are only once a day that probably are easier to take because we know it's hard to remember to take your medication. But the big thing with the steroid sprays is they're not a stop-and-start approach. If you're going to need it, you will be on it for most of your hay fever season because it takes a bit of time to create the reduction in the swelling and the inflammation in the nasal spray. So unlike the antihistamine that you can stop and start, so not necessarily need on the rainy days but take on the sunny days, if you're on a nasal spray or if you've been on it last year, you should restart it at the beginning of your hay fever season and stay on it right through to the end.
All right, daily, just daily dosage, whether you've felt the onset of symptoms or not, but antihistamines more in response to the onset of symptoms. Would that be right?
That would be right. And now also we have some nasal sprays that have a combination of an antihistamine and a steroid in them. So again, you would take that regularly every day.
And for long term, tackling it long term, you know, for people who know they're going to get it and want to kind of have a preventative measure in place, is there anything for them?
Well, number one, I think if you know you get hay fever, then the big thing is, again, as we said, start your medication, start that nasal spray before your symptoms are going to develop. So work out the time-wise and start the spray there and then. For those who have really had kind of severe symptoms and perhaps have complications as a result of it, like flares of their asthma, there are newer treatments. Such as immunotherapy with desensitization. And we have medications, both oral medication, that means taking a sublingual tablet every day for 3 years, and that's very good for grass pollen-mediated hay fever and a couple of others. But also there are newer injections for those who are very severely affected. Those obviously require referral on in the majority of times to a specialist centre, to an allergy clinic. And again, most people can be managed with the nasal spray and with the antihistamines.
All right. And finally and briefly, if you would, the environmental management of it, if the neighbour is cutting the grass or whatever, is it a case of close the windows and stay indoors?
Yeah, keep the windows in your house closed during peak pollen hours. So that tends to be from late morning to late afternoon, especially your bedroom windows. And keep the windows closed while you're driving. Wraparound sunglasses, they talk about if you're outdoors in pollen areas and sunny kind of areas with lots of trees and things. Wear a face mask if you're going to cut the grass, or ideally don't be the one to cut the grass and stay away from it. And they talk about simple measures, putting Vaseline on the inside of each nostril, and that perhaps could potentially prevent pollen coming inside the nose. But, I mean, I'm not sure I want to be going around with a big blob of Vaseline, so I don't think it's going to be that effective. Showering and changing your clothes if you've been out walking in the park, washing your bed sheets regularly. They're kind of the simple things, and again, having your medication ready.
Fine advice for hay fever sufferers there from Dr. Ilona Duffy on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. Former magazine editor Vicky Notaro has published her first novel, Reality Check. And Vicky joined Ray Darcy in studio this afternoon to talk about it.
Sort of Kardashians with a Kerry twist.
Yeah, I mean, Kardashians meets The Real Housewives with a Kerry twist.
With a Kerry
twist.
That's
how I pitched it. That was my
that
elevator
you,
pitch.
There you go. So I did well, didn't
yeah,
I?
Yeah, great. Yeah, yes. Full marks.
Thank you very much. So we'll talk about the novel in a moment. But first, you know, magazine editor, solid job, journalism, solid job.
Yeah, really? Well, nowadays?
Well, compared to being a novelist, I suppose
yeah,
it is,
fair.
Isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So was this a niche you had to scratch?
Absolutely, right. Yes. And I was going to scratch it regardless.
All right.
But I had decided after 15 years working in magazines, working solely in magazines, to kind of leave my current job and see what happened. You know, go out into the world and see what else might
like
strike
free-fall.
Me.
Free-fall.
Yeah, kind of free-fall. Yeah. But like, it just felt very necessary at the time to try something else because I got corrupted by the media, as I like to say. I got into magazines when I was 22.
Right.
I was actually still in college and I worked my way up pretty quickly mostly because I was a lick. And yeah, that's what happens.
Very honest.
Yeah, in Irish media. And I felt like by the time I was 37, I'd kind of done an awful lot. I'd kind of reached the top of the tree.
Give us your CV now, briefly.
Well, I started in Kiss magazine, which was a lovely teenage girls magazine, and it was a dream job. I was there for 4 years and I left when I was deputy editor. Wow. And I was going to move to London, thought about it, decided not to. I didn't want to be, you know, I'd rather be a medium-sized fish in a small pond.
Yeah.
So I went freelance for a couple of years. Well, actually, no, I went freelance and ended up in the Indo pretty quickly. And I was editing supplements there for 3 years. So that was a huge job, a huge responsibility for a 27-year-old woman. And I was there for a couple of years, went freelance again, was writing for anyone who'd have me. And then I went back to the Kiss magazine stable, to Stellar magazine, as editor-in-chief in 2017. Right. And then I became managing director of that company when I was 33.
Wow.
So I didn't love that side of it. I didn't love the management end of it. But again, I'm a lick. So when I was offered the opportunity, I said, I'll give it a whirl. And obviously then the pandemic happened and the business changed entirely. And I just got to a point where I said, look, the kind of magazine world has lost its luster for me a little bit. Mm. And I've always wanted to write a novel.
That was age.
Yeah, I absolutely part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, I could only do so many Christmas gift guides and feel excited about them. And it feels weird because when I started out, I was the most eager beaver and I really did give it my all for those 15 years. And I'm so grateful for the career. I've done amazing things. Mm. But I just, in terms of the day to day, I thought journalism has changed. The world has changed. Social media is so huge now. I'm just going to see what happens. And very serendipitously, I was approached by Penguin to write a book, and it all just kind of happened.
There's a lot of you in it, although there isn't. But you are nearly obsessed with reality TV. So the backdrop for this novel is reality TV.
Yes,
Desi, who's the one of the main characters. She's the matriarch, the mother in the family,
the momager.
She's in Lola, which is Ladies of LA.
Yes, and that's heavily inspired by the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I started watching, when you're editing a magazine from home during a pandemic, it's a very lonely experience because, you know, working on a mag is very communal. You're out at events and shoots and meetings. So it was very lonely and I had a lot of time on my hands. So I really got into watching The Housewives and Desi appeared to me as if like a ghost, you know, because there isn't an Irish Real Housewife. There's an English one. There's, you know.
Well, there was some iteration of it on Virgin Media.
There was Dublin
Media
Wives
one.
Here.
Yes, Dublin
yeah,
Wives,
but it wasn't, it was slightly different shows.
Yes.
But there is like,
it's not part of the franchise. It wasn't part of the franchise.
No, it was, they changed their name to Dublin Wives.
Yes, yes, yeah.
But there's a very famous English Real Housewife called Lisa Vanderpump, and Desi is heavily inspired by her. And Kris Jenner, and you know.
So Desi in the novel, born in Kerry, has, you know, unrequited love or something, some guy that broke her heart, went off with her best friend, and she ups and leaves to America.
Yeah, she, like a lot of people did in the 80s.
Yes,
she went
to
the States with her sisters and found, she's beautiful and fabulous. So she found work as a model, met a producer, fell in love, moved to LA. And yeah, over the years, she's kind of done a bit of everything in order to keep her family afloat.
So we find her in her 60s. She has three grown-up daughters. The oldest is Portia. She's the main character.
She is. It's written from Portia's point of view.
Yes. Yeah. Who is a similar age to yourself.
She is. Yeah.
Yes. And she has something else in common in that she has decided not to have children.
Yes.
Which you have. And then there's her younger sister, Lavinia.
No. Lavinia. Yeah.
And Lavinia is an influencer.
Yes.
And then there's the youngest, Ariel, who's heading into that world.
She's a 15-year-old brat.
Yes, yeah.
She's a TikToker.
And then there's all the men.
All the men that populate their lives.
Yeah, yes.
And complicate their lives.
Yeah, yeah. We're in their orbit. And David, who's Irish, who's the gay hairdresser. And then there's isn't he?
He is, yeah.
And then Jason is the first of many love interests. I was exhausted after reading it because there's so much going on in it. It's jam-packed with action.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I remember early days with my editor. She said, God, there's a lot of plot.
Yes.
And I said, well, I want it to be like that. You know, I want it to have twists and turns and surprises.
Yeah.
Even though it's a, you know, it's a funny, I hope, escapist novel, I still want there to be some suspense and, you know, wondering what might happen. I didn't want it to be very obvious what would happen.
And for the first good bit of the book, 120, 150 pages, that whole thing about whether to have children or not is a main theme. So you gave a lot of yourself then, did you? Because you've had those chats, have you, over the years?
I mean, I was very lucky in that I met a man and married a man who very much wants the same as me, which is to be child-free by choice.
Right.
So, I mean, I've definitely had the conversations with other people over the years. It's never been quite as tumultuous for me as it is for Portia because, yes. You know, she's put in a position...
Don't get too much away.
It's on the first chapter. She's put in a position where, you know, the love of her life tells her that he wants something very different than what they'd kind of agreed. Mm. And she's that kind of throws her for a loop and she has to consider, does she want this relationship enough to kind of alter her entire being?
Mm.
So, I mean, I just wanted a humdinger of an opening, if I'm really honest, and I could relate.
Just by coincidence, we spoke to Joe Humphreys earlier in the week about what philosophers say about having children.
Oh, right.
Yeah, no, look, it's a big question, you know. And I'm wondering, why did you decide, if you don't mind me asking you?
It's just always been how I've been. From when I was a little girl, I always said, I don't want babies. I don't want to be a mammy. I'm not interested. And I think a lot of, I've spoken and written about it a lot because I realised very early on that it was quite unusual.
Mm.
And everyone would say, don't be silly, I'll change your mind, you know. And I guess I've always been interested and preoccupied with the idea that it is a decision and a choice that you can make for yourself. And I just want to normalise all different sorts of families.
Interesting that what you say there, because it is a decision you make.
Of course.
Because for some people, they don't think about it too much.
Some people think of it as a given.
Yes, yes. And actually, Joe or I said the other day that you have to give it a lot more thought if you decide to, you know, by choice, remain childless.
Yeah, yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like, even from a logistical point of view, yeah, you do.
Vicky Notaro, former magazine editor and now debut novelist, talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon. Vicky's book, Reality Check, is published by Sandy Cove. This morning, Oliver Callan spoke to two union reps. Suzanne Armstrong is a bus driver with Dublin Bus, and Marina Hampton is a Belfast-based actor. They're both shop stewards with their respective unions, SIP2 and Equity. Oliver started his chat with Suzanne.
You're a Dublin bus driver.
I am, yeah.
Yeah, very proud of it and everything. What brought you into that line of work?
Actually, it was my mum. She wanted to be a bus driver and she asked me to apply for her online. And then I said, sure, I'll give it a go.
So you applied for her?
Yeah. She's not great with computers.
Okay, very good. And did you the business for her?
Yeah.
Did she become a bus driver?
She did. We're in the same garage.
Very good. And you're in the same garage. Where's the garage, by the way?
Harristown, near the airport.
Oh, near the airport. Okay. Oh, yes, Harristown. I passed that before. So you were a mother-daughter Dublin bus driving outfit.
I think we might be the only mother and daughter bus drivers in Dublin Bus.
Probably so. Where did you end up? What sort of path did you take to decide, about this job is definitely for me?
Do you know what? I had two young kids at the time.
Yeah.
And there was evening and weekend work. And I said, so that might suit around my husband's hours.
So the sort of shift work suited grand. Were there many women bus drivers there when you first came?
No, I could be corrected on figures, but I think we've close to 180 women now.
That's much more than I
think
people
would. There was less than 100 when I started. Yeah.
How long ago was that?
8 years.
8 years you've been doing. You love the job?
Most of it.
A mixed review there. But you've stuck at it for 8 years. There must be something about it that you enjoy.
Yeah, no, I like the job. I've no intention of going anywhere else, I think.
Yeah, that's a positive sign.
Absolutely.
What is it like being a bus driver? Do you stick to a particular route all the time? Is that how it works?
So I'm a spare bus driver. So that just means I'll do whatever route.
That must be a better term.
No, I'm spare. That's what we say. So you can be marked in or you can be spare. If you're marked in, you have a set route. You know exactly what you're doing.
That's
you're spare,
the term, yeah.
You just do as you're told.
Your mum is still bus driving.
She is.
So would she be the marked in driver?
No, she's spare as well.
Oh, and that's to do with the amount of days you want to work, is it?
It's to do the days. It's also your seniority. So it takes a while to get marked in. Like if you could just walk in there and know that you'd have a set route, that would be amazing. That's the dream. That's what we all aim for.
Well, and would you not prefer to sort of do a different route each time?
Do you know, it's nice to have the same passengers getting on. It's nice to have regulars.
Yeah, people that you know and so on.
But it's also nice to have variety, so, you know.
And plus, you know, you can expect what's happening along the line more so, perhaps. I'd imagine most people listening are thinking, Dublin bus drivers, they must have it difficult at the moment, safety and security wise.
Absolutely. So actually with SIP2, we're running a Respect Transport Workers campaign. And that is all about improving conditions for the drivers and for passengers.
Yeah, it was just so important. What have you seen in your 8 years, and has there been a change between when you started and where things are now?
Yeah, there has. So obviously I've seen a lot and I've heard a lot from my colleagues. Yeah. And I think since COVID it's gotten a bit worse, but I don't want to put people off. It is still a great job. I'm still happy there. But I think if we could just get, you know, more security, like transport police or something, just to improve the safety for everybody, that would be great.
I think that's that call has been echoed all around the place, hasn't it?
Well, it is, because, like, you know, we want the passengers to be safe. People need to use public transport. We're trying to encourage it. And then they're like, oh, well, actually, I don't feel safe getting on that route, or I don't feel safe at that time, or I wouldn't put my daughter on that bus, you know?
How does it work when you are doing so many different routes? I mean, you must have an encyclopedic knowledge of Dublin bus routes.
So no one believes me, but I'm really bad at directions, right? Even trying to find my way here. So I was in the car, but I was actually driving a bus route to get here. Because I don't take the shortcuts. So we're trained. When we go in, there's a mentor program set up. So what they will do is the new drivers will have a mentor. They'd be trained on 3 routes and they'd be left on the routes for 10 weeks, give or take. And that's something the trade unions have put in place, obviously, to make sure everyone feels safe going out. And then they'll route train them on more routes as they go along. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't get past the idea that you've driven the entire bus route yourself.
I combined a few different bus routes to get here.
Were you tempted to stop along the way and pick people up?
Do you know, I have done that before. Someone puts their hand out and you go to pull in. You go, oh, I'm in my car today.
Demanding exact change. Sorry. And I'll come to your, Suzanne, I'll come back to you because you're a shop steward.
Absolutely.
First of two, I want to come back to your union story as well. But I want to bring in Marina Hampton now at this stage, because Marina Hampton is not a bus driver, Marina.
No,
tell us
not.
What you do for a living.
Yes, I'm an actor.
Yeah.
One of my many jobs. Yeah, I'm an actor. So I'm rep. We don't call ourselves shop stewards. We would be reps.
Oh, that's interesting. Reps. Yes, because I was wondering. And do you use the term, Suzanne's nodding here as well. You say rep now? Sorry, union reps. Marina, yeah. I'll come back to you. I'll come with you, just as a problem here with Suzanne's microphone. But Marina, So it's union reps. But as an actor, tell us your path into that job and how it's been going for you.
Well, I started off doing Amdram. I remember being in school doing acting and the teachers wanted me to go to drama school, but it was so expensive. And we were kind of, I think my dad was unemployed at the time. So I just went into Amdram, and that being a professional actor was just a far off dream that beautiful people have. Yeah. So I did Amdram, and then I kind of volunteered then for professional theatre companies to help out doing anything. And then I kind of I did extras work as well on big sets. And then actually that was how I made my money, so I could become an equity member as well at that stage.
Very good,
so they,
yes.
So supporting artists.
But they
fight
for actors. And tell us how important equity was at that stage for you.
It was very important for a few reasons, actually. Mm. When you're an actor, you're self-employed.
Yeah.
So the equity gives you public liability insurance for £10 million. And also you have legal aid. So you don't have, you're not working in an office. You don't have kind of comrades to help. So you're completely on your own, and really large theatre companies, really large production companies. It just makes you feel secure that you have a really large union backing you up. So, and also it meant if I get in early, I could get my own name, because there can only be one Marina Hampton.
Is that right? Okay.
Yes,
right.
Which I got, because I was I had a backup name. I had Greta Gray as my backup name.
Greta Gray.
So it's my middle name and my granny's maiden name.
Very, very
so
interesting.
I thought,
that's
but
how
I
the
thought
actress
if I get called, if I get called, I'm going to go, ooh, who's Greta Gray? Look around the room.
You don't remember who it is.
I have to remember.
So
I'm
there's
Greta
only
Gray.
One Marina Hampton, that's you. So what happens to the next Marina Hampton?
Well, she'll have to pick something else.
Okay, very good. So I can see how it can be a lonely world. You're self-employed and now you have someone to go to if there's a problem in a union.
Yes.
That's Belfast-based actor Marina Hampton and Dublin bus driver Suzanne Armstrong talking about their experiences of being in unions with Oliver Callan this morning. Not in unions with Oliver Callan, but you know what I mean. A new ESRI study was discussed by Cullum O'Mungoin and one of its authors, Professor Pete Lunn, who's head of the Behavioural Research Unit with the Economic Social Research Institute. The study was titled What is Preventing Individual Climate Action? And one of the most surprising findings is that just 4% of Irish people realise that diet has an impact on our carbon footprint. Cullum asked Pete why he thought so few people link diet with emissions.
There is a clear failure to understand how important food is relative to transport and energy. So, for example, about sort of two-thirds of our sample are aware that how they travel really matters for their carbon footprint. More than half are aware that how they use energy in the home matters for their carbon footprint. And if you compare that to our responses on diet, you can see there's a huge gap. So that's why today we're emphasising the fact that food is a really important part of your emissions. Now, even
How big?
Well, I need to be careful. I'm a behavioural scientist, not a scientist who studies emissions. But, I mean, the agricultural sector in Ireland is the highest emitting sector of our sectors, which is something that previously we have reported the public hasn't yet absorbed, or at least a lot of the public hasn't fully understood. So the importance of food, not only globally, but also in Ireland for your carbon emissions, is a very important sector. And the crucial thing to get across here is it is what you eat more than it's how it's packaged or where it comes from. And primarily when we're talking about what you eat, we're talking about how much red meat you eat is the biggest factor which governs your emissions from your diet.
Right. But you did find that people had changed their diet, did you?
Yeah. So it's interesting. About a quarter of the population says they have changed their diet in order to reduce their emissions. So that might sound like a contradiction, but when we went through the diaries about what's in people's minds about what's really causing the most emissions, whereas there's some people who do go to the supermarket and when they're offered more sustainable produce, they might actually buy more sustainable food. And about a quarter of the population say they have made some changes. There's another quarter who say they'd like to, but they don't have the knowledge. I mean, they confess to us that they don't really know which foods they need to eat or necessarily how to prepare them. And they also raise cost as an issue, which is interesting because it suggests again that people are more thinking about, you know, buying organic or high-value produce, thinking that's more sustainable, whereas actually simply cutting the amount of red meat in your diet will reduce your personal emissions by a lot, and actually, if anything, is going to be cheaper for your budget, not more expensive.
All right. Well, so that's where people maybe aren't aware of their carbon footprint. But in terms of your research, where did people have a good awareness of their carbon footprint? What do they associate with emissions?
So people were much better, as I said, about transport and energy, although even there are some wrinkles. So about one in every five car drivers didn't spontaneously mention the fact that they'd driven during their day as being an important part of their emissions, where actually it would be. And on energy, although more than half the population saying, yeah, you know, our home energy use matters, again, there would be a tendency to think that was more about cooking, watching the television and turning lights on came up a lot, whereas people need to understand that the biggest impact that you have domestically is really through heating hot water, heating your home and using the white appliances like washing machines and tumble dryers and so on. So again, there's more understanding that needs to be communicated here.
Now, maybe you've already said it, but what time of year did you contact this, or did you conduct the survey at?
Yeah, so the survey was done during the autumn. Which means that not everybody would necessarily have been heating their homes at that time, although some people would have done. But certainly people are heating hot water, and heating hot water is one of the biggest impacts that your home has and how you do that.
In terms of people's intentions then, how much do they want to do? Because you mentioned when they go to the supermarket, they would like alternatives. But, you know, if the flesh is weak, how willing is the spirit?
Well, certainly there's quite a lot of people who are willing. Now, I mean, about half of the population don't see a need to change their diet for climate reasons. But as we can see from the study, that may be primarily because they don't really understand how big an impact it has. One needs to be really careful here, because actually, in terms of attitudes and opinions, the Irish public is really lined up behind climate action. I mean, the overwhelming majority are either worried or very worried about the state of the climate, about climate change. And we have very low levels of climate denial in Ireland, less than 2% of the population. It's almost so low you can't measure it, don't believe in human-caused climate change. So attitudes and willingness are there, but people's understanding and skills and how they perceive what's around them and can use it are not. And that's where there's a really important role for communication here. I mean, interestingly, at the moment, the Climate Action Plan doesn't contain a strategy for getting more sustainable diets in Ireland. That's something that this report suggests would be helpful.
All right. And in the messaging, what does work in terms of getting people to change their behaviour? Because, you know, it's been pretty clearly spelled out what the implications of climate change are, both in the near and long term. So the fear-based message may not be the one that would get people to change. Are there any other nudges that people could be applied to people?
I wouldn't call them nudges, but there are certainly ways of describing climate action that are likely to be more fruitful. One of the reasons people don't act, apart from the fact they're not sure what the best thing to do is and they find it very confusing, is because they're worried they'll be the only mug who does. You know, it's one of these collective action problems where we all have to act together. If everybody moves at the same time, if everybody starts changing their behaviour, then more people will feel comfortable to go to the extra effort and sometimes the extra expense to actually do it. So part of it is about supporting that collective effort. And it's also about rewarding that collective effort. Now, that means communicating all that is going on, so particular sectors don't feel like they're being picked on, because different people are being asked to do different things in this space. If you live in a rural environment, you're being asked to change your behaviour in different ways than someone who lives in an urban environment, for example. So we need to communicate all the different ways that people are changing their behaviour, and we need to view it as a collective problem and communicate in that way.
And if you're going to change, you need an alternative. So the provision of alternatives, so for example in the area of transport and that, people, do they need to see clear alternatives that makes the pathway to transitioning to a different choice easier?
Yes, and that's an important point, because another thing that came out of this study was there are a lot of people here who say they would be willing to change their transport behaviour if there was convenient and affordable public transport available to them, but for their travel patterns at the moment there isn't. So what that means is there is a lot of pent-up demand for more public transport, some for active travel as well, and that means that the effort and the investment that we're putting in that space, at least according to the evidence we've supplied in this study, would seem to be money well spent. That from the point of view of climate action, giving people more affordable public transport, more public transport, expanding that further, expanding active travel further, all of that would seem to make sense.
And is there evidence that maybe people know in theory that climate change is an issue, but they haven't integrated that knowledge into how they behave?
Yes, absolutely. And of course, it's very difficult. I mean, on a day-to-day basis, we all have immediate priorities and we have to get through our days, and there are so many things we have to think about and so many decisions we have to make. And I think that tells you something very important here, which is this cannot be left to individual action. I mean, this report today is about how difficult people find it to engage in individual action, what more we can do to support them. But at the end of the day, it's going to be regulations, it's going to be taxes, it's going to be subsidies, it's going to be infrastructure. Those are the really biggest system changes that are going to have to be made. You want that to dovetail with your individual action. You want people to understand why those things are being put in place. You want people to understand what causes their emissions. But at the end of the day, we can't leave this up to individuals, because it's too hard for ordinary people to do this. They've got to have more support, and there has to be far more resources and money spent in this space if we're going to get the kind of changes that we need.
Professor Pete Lunn, who's head of the Behavioural Research Unit with the ESRI, discussing the Institute's new report on individual climate action with Cullum O'Mungon this morning. The difficulty of getting your child into a creche was highlighted on this afternoon's Liveline when Sarah told Katie Hannan about her imminent move to Cork and how hard it's been to get a creche place for her son.
Well, both my husband and I were originally from Cork. We've been living in Dublin for a long number of years. We had our first little boy a year and a half ago, and we've made the decision to move our family back home to Cork to be closer to supports and back home to the real capital.
To the real capital. Okay. I know you're in the middle of packing up today, actually, aren't you?
Yeah, today's my last day in my current job, yeah.
Oh. So that all sounds great, and I am sure you are delighted and looking forward to it, but you have hit a bump in the road.
We have, yeah. So, I mean, everything was falling into place very much for us with jobs and everything. We were very, very lucky. The day my husband got his job offer in his hand, the first thing we did was we decided to ring for creche places for our son. So that day I sat down with a list of 15 different creches in front of me, and I rang every single one of them. And the best offer that I was given for a child care place for my son was that he was number 80 on the wait list for 2026.
80 on the wait list.
80
for 2026.
Yeah. Yes, and that was the best offer. There was an awful lot of the creches don't even have wait list open anymore, because they were telling me there's so many people on the list that they didn't think it was ethical to even tell people there was a wait list anymore.
So I'm sure after the first two or three you were thinking, oh my God, this is taking longer than yeah. I thought. But after 15...
yeah, you really start to panic a little bit,
when you're imagine.
In that position. Now, obviously, we're in Dublin at the moment, and we were very aware that the situation is also very, very bad here. When I found out I was pregnant with my son at only 4 weeks, I was ringing creches to try and make sure that I could get a creche place for 6 months, which was our plan, not suited our family, which is obviously very difficult for people. You know, if people have a history of child loss or anything like that, that's a particularly difficult thing to ask people to do.
I know, that is so early, 4 weeks into a pregnancy. You barely know you're pregnant.
Oh, no, actually, I was ringing creches telling them I was expecting. You know, it's a very weird situation.
We're having a little bit of dropout on your line, Sarah, but it sounds pretty good. We'll stick with it. You did find a creche place while you were in Dublin, obviously.
We did. We were lucky enough to get something relatively close to home, probably because I rang so early. I know I have colleagues and friends looking for creche places who haven't been so lucky in the Dublin area. Mm.
So what are you going to do now? You are, as you say, this is your last day at work. This is your last day packing up. Yeah. What's the plan now with your son?
The plan with our son is we've been at least fortunate enough to get a childminder for May, which we're very delighted about, and great. But obviously, my son, he's very social. He loves the creche environment that he's in at the moment. It really seems to suit his personality. We love the flexibility of it, that, you know, if somebody is ill who's in his room taking care of him, that there's an extra staff member there. You know, we don't have to take holidays when a childminder is taking holidays, etc. And they have, you know, excellent developmental supports and kind of age-appropriate toys, etc. in the rooms. It's an environment that we're very happy for our son to be in. So it's a bit of a disappointment to us that it's not a route that we could go down in Cork. It just wasn't an option for us, which we found very frustrating for that reason, but also for financial reasons as well. The National Childcare Scheme and the ECC schemes largely support the creches, but it's nigh on impossible to get a childminder who'll allow you to avail of those government supports. So the cost per month is far, far higher for us moving to a childminder compared to the
creche. Yeah, and I think a childminder can maybe work if you have two or more children. That would be also very expensive in a creche. But for one child, a childminder, that's a very, very expensive option, obviously.
Yeah, it is. It is a huge cost, yeah.
And as you say, it's the idea as well about wanting your child to be socialised, because that's what we're hearing. Exactly. Since COVID, a lot of children didn't get socialised, and that there's this whole generation of toddlers who you know, only saw adults over that period. And you, as you say, you want your child to have that experience.
Absolutely. And I mean, he certainly loves that. And it's one of the things that I'm most grateful that we were able to give him as a gift, actually, is he started creche so early, and it was a huge advantage. Everybody comments when they meet him for the first time how comfortable he is with new people, how good he is with other children. It's fantastic. It's been fantastic, I think.
I think somebody might be trying to call you there, because there's a slight dropout. If anyone's trying to call Sarah, please hold off until she's finished with Lifeline. Sarah, tell me, what was the draw to go back? Is your husband Cork as well, or are you dragging him to somewhere?
No, there's no dragging. It's very mutual. We're both from Cork originally.
And was it always the plan?
We both have family down there.
Was it always the plan to go back?
Honestly, it wasn't always the plan. You know, we had jobs here that we love. Certainly, I have a job here that I absolutely love, and it's hard to leave. But just the draw of family support and making sure that our son was growing up somewhere that we know very well and close to family was really, really important to us. And when he came along, just kind of shifted a little bit.
And of course, you didn't want your son growing up shouting for Dublin.
Oh, well, this is it.
Outrageous. He'll always be a dub. Fact. That's Sarah telling Katie Hannon on this afternoon's Liveline how hard it's been to find a creche place for her son. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, before there was an app for that, there was, well, no app for that. This morning, Colm O'Mungon heard from reporter Brian O'Connell about a small but growing trend for swapping your smartphone for a dumb phone.
Well, the first person I spoke to, Colm, is Michael Donoghue, and he works in the industry. He sells phones. He has done for many years. And he says he has seen that demand for older type phones grow, especially in the past year or two.
I see more and more people coming around to actually getting the dumb phones these days. And I see these people much happier because of it, really.
So who are the people who are coming in to you and asking for the older versions of the phones?
So mainly the older generation, but I'd say that would be stretching to the likes of your, say, your trades, your builders, your farmers of the world. Say, with the likes of the devices you'd normally see in someone's pocket, could be valued up to the likes of €1,000. These ones here, you're not paying much more, or if a lot less than €100 on. A less stressful device, I would say, because with the constant ping, ping, ping of social media, mm-hmm. You do see it in, say, especially the younger generation, whereas the older generation seem much more settled, much more happier. I would have a separate work number myself, and I have it in a little basic button Nokia 105. And we'll say if this one ever gets lifted or if this one ever breaks the screen, I always have that one to fall back on myself. So,
but for your day-to-day life, like, would it ever be an option for you to ditch the smartphone?
If I ever ended up in a job where I wouldn't have to use WhatsApp, I think that's the only thing that's dragging me to a phone, because we say with work chats, communication constantly going through that, I'd hate having this device attached to myself like the whole time, constantly having to check. Because even if you're standing alone in a room, within 2 minutes you're constantly going to a phone. So
yeah, you're not present.
Yeah, exactly. You're not living kind of in the moment. When you're in a concert, you're really enjoying your concert. You're going to take in every single thing that's there, mm-hmm. and you look around you, and then everybody has their phone in their hands, not really taking in the full moment.
I'd be worried if I traded back to the old Nokia that I'd get addicted to the snake game again.
It is quite addictive now too. That it is actually on that same Nokia 105 that I have too now.
It just
brings me back to about 20 odd years ago.
Hankering there for a game of snake. So Michael Donoghue and Cavan telling us about his experience working on the selling side of things, but you did manage to speak to one person who's ditched the smartphone for an older model.
Yes, Jodie Abernethy is an art student in Dublin, and he talked to me about why he has stuck with the non-smartphone. And I suppose it's really about the difference he feels it's had on the quality of his life, on his peace of mind. So he began calling by telling me how he came to downgrade his smartphone by accident, really. It had to go in for repair, and he was given the older model, and really he hasn't looked back since.
My phone, I actually broke my phone. I dropped it and it smashed, like, so I said, like, that's that, I'm not getting another one. So I just went into phone shop and got like a 70-year-old little Nokia. No WhatsApp. I think some of them you can get WhatsApp. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but no WhatsApp. Yeah.
So traditional text messaging.
Text messaging, yeah. The what's called, I use it for texting, alarm in the morning, calling. That's about it, yeah.
So how has it been, that transition back to the older model?
It's been great. Like, it's been a few years now, so I couldn't imagine having a smartphone, but like, I've no complaints.
But logistically, Jodie, does it mean you're going to a laptop to check emails from time to time?
Yeah, I do have a computer, so I use emails on the computer, that sort of thing. And I also have Instagram on the computer.
So do you feel now you're more present in everyday life because you don't have the distraction of a smartphone in your pocket?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that's the main thing. That's the good thing. Like,
you're more zen, are you?
Oh, yeah. Big time. I'm not like anxious by looking at Instagram like the way most people are.
Hyperstimulation is a good way of describing it. Like, there'll be some people listening who will say, I couldn't imagine living like that. But sure, we lived like that for thousands of years.
It's the natural way. Yeah. People go, oh, you're mad. Like, you have that little phone. Some people. And I think if anyone was mad, I don't think it would be me. I'm just living as natural as I can, you know? I'm just like, if I go for a walk, I don't have little things in my ears, AirPods, like walking along, you know, I can actually just be natural. And
it's giving you a peace of mind.
Yeah.
God, between present zen and peace of mind, Brian, I think there's a future there for you as a guru as well. Do we have any studies, though, on just how much you were talking there to Jodie about, you know, how people did without these things for thousands of years? But how much are we using them now? What do the studies tell us?
Yeah, sure. There's always a study, really, isn't there, Colm? One from March this year I saw from Deloitte showed just really how ingrained smartphone use is for many of us. 96% of respondents said they owned a smartphone, so that's up from last year. 67% said they wish they spent less time on their devices. That was about 80% of 18 to 24 year olds. And then a total of 98% of 18 to 75 year olds said they use their smartphone every day. So many use it during meal times, and as soon as they wake up in the morning, 74% of people reach for the smartphone. That's pretty depressing, isn't it? It says the percentage of people who check their phones at least 50 times a day is about 36%. And then the percentage who check their phones 100 times a day is about 16%. Now, just to talk about the psychology behind all of this, I did speak with Dr. Mally Kine, who's a clinical psychologist and author. And she began by telling me more and more people are talking to her about their mobile phone use.
It's really something of concern for people of all ages, I suppose, for anybody. You know, we're concerned about our teenagers, but also ourselves as adults. So downgrading to something like, you know, one of our old type of phones will prevent that, I suppose, from happening. And also, I suppose people can access the important parts of their job on their computers without maybe having access to it 24 hours a day in their pockets.
That's another part of it, isn't it, Mally, that people are kind of always on now and always accessible.
It is of concern. I mean, for me, what I've done is not kind of had work coming into my regular phone, not downloaded any apps related to work on my phone, on my personal phone, because I just don't want to be seeing that. Humans are trying to limit their behaviors, and that's why they're downgrading to maybe the more older type phones. But there's other ways of doing that with just using your smartphone, like, you know, monitoring your, you know, how much you're using it per day, restricting that access. You can do that with, I do that with my own kids, restrict their app usage when they're during the day. I've thought of doing it myself because I find myself picking up the phone quite a bit. Because when you think of it, these social media companies are spending billions of dollars trying to take away our attention and distract us. So it is a real concern. But there is this whole idea of, is it an addiction or is it a dependence? And it isn't yet classified as an addiction in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. The research is still in its infancy, mm-hmm. in terms of what it does to the brain.
Any chance of you giving up your smartphone?
I don't think so.
Dr. Mally Kine, clinical psychologist from Brian O'Connell's report for Today with Claire Byrne this morning on the small but growing trend for people replacing their smartphones with dumb phones. Snake is back, baby. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, Playback itself, will be here as usual on Saturday morning at 9:10, when Sinead will have a better, stronger, faster look back at the week in radio. But for me, until the next time, thank you for listening and good luck.